From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We are tempted to think of dictators as historical anachronisms, even buffoons, Sacha Baron Cohen style. My guest today says that view is out of date. Dictatorships have been on a learning curve, he says, and they've learned a lot in Russia, China, Venezuela, beyond, how to wrap the iron fist in a velvet glove. This hour On Point, dictatorship gets savvy, so does its opposition. You can join the conversation. Where do you see dictatorship now in the world? How do you see authoritarians adapting? And is democracy on the march, in the ascent, or not? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Will Dobson is former managing editor at Foreign Policy. He's now politics and foreign affairs editor at the website Slate. He's writing about dictators. And he says we have in our minds a kind of a caricature of what really goes on. Just last month, comedian Sacha Baron Cohen came out with his latest film, The Dictator. He had a web video released along with it. In character as the dictator threatens unimaginable consequences to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences after it rescinded his invitation to the Academy Awards ceremony. Here's the caricature style.
Good morning, great Satan of America. How are you? I am fine, thank you. On behalf of the nation of Wadia, I am outraged at being banned from the Oscars by the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Zionists. While I applaud the Academy for taking away my right to free speech, I warn you that if you do not lift your sanctions and give me my tickets back by 12 p.m. on Sunday, you will face unimaginable consequences.
And there's the send-up from Sacha Baron Cohen, but it may have something to do with the image in your mind of what dictatorship means. Will Dobson wants you to understand otherwise. His new book, and it's really interesting, is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Will Dobson, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What did you set out to look at, sir?
Well, I began actually in 2009, where I took it upon myself to try to travel to these different places around the world, and I would go to a series of authoritarian countries over those years, as you mentioned, Russia, China, Venezuela, Egypt, Malaysia, and elsewhere. And in each place, I was looking to have two conversations. I was looking to talk to people that work for these regimes, the ideologues, political advisors, cronies, technocrats that help perpetuate the system. And I wanted to understand how they do what they do, because it's important to understand that it's never been harder to be a dictator in many ways. So if you have a regime that is somehow not just surviving, but in some cases thriving, I think it's crucial that we understand how that's happening. But then the other set of conversations I would have in each of these places was to talk to the people who are really in the trenches trying to unseat these regimes. And this is a much more sort of unexpected army of people, if you will, a combination of students, academics, lawyers, philanthropists, mm-hmm. business people in some cases. And what you end up with looking at is what is really sort of, if you can imagine, sort of a global battle, a tug of war, a game of cat and mouse that's being played in all these different places. And it's really, it's an incredible dynamic because each side is innovating and changing its tactics as it reacts to the other. And then, of course, the events of 2011 put this in really stark terms for everyone.
Arab Spring, we'll look at that. I mean, Will Dobson, I wonder why look at dictators and dictatorship just now? I mean, where's the tide moving here? We had the sense
right
after the end of the Cold War in the United States that, it was democracy on the march. That was the great tide that was moving. Is that changed? Is that not the case now? What's going on?
It has changed. I mean, if you go back all the way to, Samuel Huntington identified the third wave as being this incredible moment where we saw enormous shift towards democracies in the world. And he sort of, these are sort of arbitrary, but he chose 1974 in the beginning of a military coup in Portugal. Yeah, in April 25th, at 12:25 a.m., a song played on the radio that was this cue to segments of the Portuguese military to move. And then we see moving forward from that.
To move, in this case, to against
overthrow the dictator,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Yes.
And from this point, we see sort of a tidal wave, really, across the world of, what he termed the third wave, where at 1974, there were 41 democracies in the world. By the collapse of the Soviet Union, that number had grown to 76. when we fast forward, because that was really just one chapter, in the 90s, we see more falling towards democracy and more dictatorships falling, significant ones like in Indonesia and a Suharto, and then Serbia in 2000, and all the way up to 2005, where if you compare that moment, 2005 to 1974, the number of democracies in the world had tripled. We're talking about more than 120 at that point. Mm-hmm. But then we hit a wall. And from 2005 until today, we've seen a decline in political pluralism around the world. Regimes have become more sophisticated, not necessarily right at the moment of 2005. I think they had already begun to catch on. But we really see a backlash against democracy promotion. And we see regimes that are finding new and innovative techniques, ways of refashioning their dictatorship for a modern age.
And you say even when they're deploying democracy, that can be going on. I want to think about what defines a democracy versus dictatorship when both sides of that ledger are using votes. I mean, here, and this is interesting to listen to. This was in March. You probably remember it well. This was after being elected for the third time, and despite complaints about voting irregularities, here was Russian president again, Vladimir Putin, returning to the Kremlin, and with this victory speech he delivered with tears in his eyes.
Выборы президента России – это был очень важный тест для всех нас.
This was a very important test for all of us. Test of political maturity, independence, sovereignty. We showed that no one can dictate anything to us. We showed that our people can distinguish between the desire for changes and the provocations aimed at breaking up our country.
Russia's president again, as of March, Vladimir Putin. Already said, no one can dictate to us, he says, Will Dobson. And I just want to vote, by the way, so don't call me a dictator. I mean, how do you define a dictatorship these days?
He's really a quintessential example. That's a great clip to play. Because if you look at the system in Russia, if we can focus on that one for mm-hmm. a moment, I mean, there's nothing that he has done outright that in many cases you can't find in the most humdrum European democracies. In centralizing power, and that is what he has done. He's worked sort of in the seams of the Russian political system to centralize power while always doing it through what would be ostensibly legal mechanisms. I mean, it's important. If you look at the Russian constitution, it really has – it's an excellent constitution. It has the rights and privileges that you would expect and would find in most Western constitutions. And when I talk to Russian dissidents in Moscow, they would say, it's true. On paper, it's fantastic. But the only real right or privilege that we have that's in that document is the right to leave. Putin is in some ways sort of a wonderful example because he's lived both times up close. I talk about this in the book that he was in Dresden in East Germany at the collapse of the Soviet Union. That was, East Germany was really your quintessential example of a totalitarian state.
And you're right. And he was already stationed there in 85. Just a lieutenant colonel in the KGB.
Exactly.
And watching
what
happened.
Front lines.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the front lines and he was shocked at how invasive that state was. And he said later in 2000, right after he was first elected president, that he was really, he understood from that moment on that a system built on walls could not stand. That there, he in essence knew that this was not a functioning way to go. It's too expensive to try and build that system. And ultimately,
the old
what's
Stalinist
the
style, sort of in your face, iron fist mm-hmm. everywhere. You quote him saying, "He who does not regret the breakup of the Soviet Union has no heart. He who wants to revive it in its previous form has no head." So the mm-hmm. form he's reviving it in, what, still centralized authority but with a whole legal lattice work around it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, and it's interesting. A few weeks ago after he was actually inaugurated and began his new presidential term, mm-hmm. he was concerned about the rising number of protests that were going to be planned for that first week. What did he do? Did he crush it? No. He went to the Duma and he had a law passed in order to raise the fines for those who are conducting what are deemed illegal protests mm-hmm. in the street. I talked to some of his political advisors and they sort of asked them what his concerns were, and they said their concerns are exactly what you're expressing. They said, he understands that there's trade-offs in trying to centralize a political system too much, because when you do, you don't get good information. You're surrounded by yes men, and you've already sort of stripped the institutions of sort of the feedback that they can give you.
So he wants a little opposition, a little democracy, kind of as a radar.
He needs opposition, in fact.
So what's a dictatorship, Will? Well, how do you define what's a dictatorship these days and what's not? I mean, how do you nail it down?
Right. Well, that is the essence of the phenomenon itself, which is that it's very difficult to nail it down. I mean, the whole point of these regimes in many ways is to make it as fuzzy as possible. So what you find is there a parliament in Russia? Absolutely, there is. Is it a rubber stamp body? Yes, it is. I talked to members of the Duma who said, you know, we really should rename this institution that I'm a part of as the Ministry of Lawmaking, because we're really just an appendage of the executive. But it's more than just the facade. And I think that's what people sort of a mistake that people often make. So they think, well, this is just so much window dressing. No, it's you know, it is window dressing. But for it to really be effective, Putin understands that he needs to sort of make up for what he's lost in having a raucous legislature. So he creates a new institution called the Public Chamber, which is made up of people that in some instances are actually critics of the regime. And they weigh in. But what's the difference? They don't have the power to vote. So he's looking to get what he loses by centralizing the system and making sure that it moves in lockstep with him. But at the same time, you know, it is the case that really the number of people that control Russia, you know, this is from a Russian publication itself. They said you could fit it in a small phone book.
This is really interesting stuff. You quote Eleanor Roosevelt. This was in France, 1948. She says, "Democracy, freedom, human rights have come to have a definite meaning to the people of the world, which we must not allow any nation to so change that they're made synonymous with suppression and dictatorship." But in a way, that's what you're describing going on right here. A lot of savvy and subtlety moving into the realm of authoritarianism and repression. Will Dobson is with us. His new book is The Dictator's Learning Curve: Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. It raises all kinds of questions. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new subtle face of dictatorship, sort of a Big Brother getting smart theme here, and dictatorship versus democracy, where those lines run, dictatorships around the world putting their iron fist in a velvet glove, and how opposition is pushing back. Will Dobson is with us, politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate. He's author of the new book, The Dictator's Learning Curve: Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. And he's really gone all over trying to track down exactly how this is working. Brings us a lot of voices. We've got some voices right here. This is a little bit of the Chinese artist and dissident Ai Weiwei. He talked in a 2010 interview with CNN's Christiane Amanpour about power in his country, China.
From very young age, I start to understand that this nation has no humanity. They crash down everybody who has different opinions. Not even different opinions, just a different attitude you can cost your life.
Different attitude can cost you your life. There's one very critical voice on the way things are done in China. There are elections out there, too, but what do they mean exactly? Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, said he would be a leader for all Egyptians when he stepped up after finally being named the winner. But many Egyptians question the extent of his authority with the military behind him. Yesterday, one Egyptian told the BBC he's worried about how much power the country's newly elected leader actually has.
Mohamed Morsi will come handcuffed without any real powers, so the people could revolt against him, and he'll only last for a few months. The reason for this is that all the laws are in the hands of the military council.
Will Dobson is with us. The book is The Dictator's Learning Curve. Let's get right to our listeners. Paula in Innisbrug Falls, Vermont. Paula, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My concern is why Venezuela gets such top star billing as a dictatorship. I find it kind of puzzling. I think there's some things that are problematic, but it definitely is a democracy with very contentious elections. And I think sometimes we are, as a country, U.S., very quick to label certain countries as despotic and so on because we don't like their politics. And so I just question why this gets rubber stamped as a dictatorship. So.
Fair question. Let me put it right to Will Dobson, Paul, and I appreciate your call. Okay, well, here's the line drawing exercise.
Yeah,
and Paula
right.
says, hey, what's up, Will? What gives you, you know, the chutzpah to draw the line there? is this easy American labeling and finger pointing?
Right. Yeah, right. No, I mean, Paula is exactly right. I mean, I think it's, you know, Venezuela is truly one of the murkiest examples. And it is because, you know, what's at work, you know, and you'll get this from the opposition when you talk to opposition politicians there. They will tell you there is no question that they have lost elections and that the election day in Venezuela, they would say, you know, is there fraud? Yeah, sure there is. But just like, you know, in so many places around the world, not enough to actually overturn the result. Election day in Venezuela, I think by most accounts, is a free and fair day. The problem is the other 364 days. Where you have a regime that has very effectively been able to silence opposition on all those days. Again, it sort of is an example of Chavez requires the opposition because he has essentially denuded that system of anything other than the ballot to make it a claim to democracy. So, for example, all institutions are completely centralized in one person's control. No Supreme Court decision has ever been decided against Chavez. People are under incredible amounts of surveillance. I mean, just to give one sort of example that I cite in the book is, you know, a mother and daughter talking on the phone about politics. The mother lives in Caracas. The daughter lives in Washington. Two nights later, they find that their conversation is broadcast on national television, and a political commentator comes out to dissect that conversation. What no one does in Venezuela is question the fact that their phones are being tapped. That is actually considered, you know, well, that's just something that happens. That doesn't square with our notion of democracy. The regime itself is seen to it that the one thing that has actually sort of prospered or still works in this system is the National Electoral Council, because the level of gerrymandering is really something that it makes what happened in the American South 50 years ago look like amateur hour. This is a ridiculously sophisticated regime, and I have to say that the communication strategy that Chavez has is really, I think, among all of them, maybe perhaps the best, the most sophisticated of all, because, you know, I think that when you look at it, particularly from afar, you have every reason to say, you know what, I actually do see a lot of the elements of a democracy there. You do. But when you look up close, you see a very different picture.
Let's hear from a little bit from Chavez himself. This was a 2009 interview with CNN, then CNN's Larry King. And he asked the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, about what was then a recent referendum that removed term limits for elected officials, including himself, Chavez. King asked him if the aim was to be president for life, and Chavez said no.
We have created a participatory democracy, moving away from the liberal democracy, the democracy of the rich and the elite against the poor. The people decided to amend the constitution and opening the possibility not only for the president, but also to the mayors, to governors, to the deputies. They can be elected without time limit.
Una democracia? Completa. Yo no diría completa,
no? Well, full democracy, no. A democracy in development, in progress.
A democracy in development. Well, Dobson, it kind of brings us back to Paula's question, and I put it to, so then, you know, is this just your political reading? I mean, here's Chavez saying, no, we're just trying to have a democracy of everybody, not of just the rich and the elite against the poor. So how do you decide and come down and say, sorry, Chavez, this is dictatorship?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's really not even my decision to make. And what I try to do in the book is I talk to, and you know, this is very important to me, I talk to both sides, and you'll hear the Chavista voices in my book as well as you'll hear from the opposition. What you see here though is, you know, again, very creative uses of power. Another one that I think is a powerful example is the use of political persecution or fear in a place like this, because as one member of the opposition put it to me, you know, look, fear doesn't leave fingerprints. How is that used? For example, all people's voting history, millions of Venezuelans, how they voted on past referendums, that information was put on a website and then copied onto compact discs and then disseminated around the country in an environment that is politically as polarized as Venezuela. This is an incredibly powerful thing where I actually had the experience of standing on a street corner in Caracas and having someone come up to me to sell what I thought were going to be sort of knockoff DVDs. Mm-hmm. They were, in fact, the political histories of millions of Venezuelans, how they had voted in referendums, whether they had received support from the state, their names, their addresses, their voting numbers. This then information is then used by employers to decide who they should hire, who they shouldn't hire. It's not necessarily that they're pro-Chavez or not, just they don't want to hire an employee that's going to possibly give them a problem with the state. Opposition leaders, when they win elections, the first thing that does happen when they win on the state level is they lose all their resources, garbage trucks, streets, budgets, everything is stripped. And so they have to come up with very creative ways of being able to find a way to service the population that they're trying to serve. Mm-hmm. It's a very irregular situation.
Will Dobson writes, modern authoritarians have successfully honed new techniques, methods, and formulas for preserving power, refashioning dictatorship for the modern age. He says, today's dictators understand that in a globalized world, the more brutal forms of intimidation, mass arrests, firing squads, violent crackdowns, are best replaced with more subtle forms of coercion, not forcible arrests, but to deploy tax collectors or health inspectors to shut down dissident groups. You know, pretty soon, though, you're going to sound like, I don't know, the American right wing going after Barack Obama.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the thing. I mean, what we're talking about here is you can look at these trends, and I think it doesn't really matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. There are things here that I think would be concerning to people of any political stripe. You know, in the case of, again, just to go back to the case of Venezuela, I mean, the way that laws are written, they're written, and this is common in many places, they're written very broadly, very vaguely, in fact, but then they're only applied in a very selective way. And again, to go back to sort of where the rubber hits the road, mm-hmm. I attended a rally in one area of the state of Miranda, which is really one of Venezuela's most politically important states. And it's a state that's the governor is Enrique Capriles, the man who's currently now trying to run against Chavez. And they gave me a tour of this school where the rally was going to take place. It was a school that had just recently been refurbished. And they took me through, and we went through, and it was what you'd expect, you know, one classroom after another, an assembly hallway, so on. And then they opened up another door, and I saw a dentist office in the middle of this grade school. And I said, wait a minute, why is there, you know, an examination room and dentist office in the middle of the school? And they said, well, what we've done is the people here are very proud of this school, and they've wanted it desperately. And now that it's been refurbished and it's ready for them, we have begun to take basic sort of social services offices and put them in places like this, because when Chavez and the central government strip us of these resources, it's very hard to take this from the people if we actually put the services in something like a school, which they'll never hand over. And no political lackey would ever seek to try to seize this. And so the oppositions in these countries, and this is true, you know, across the board, they have to be extremely creative in order to find a way to actually perform. Because if they don't, at the end of the day, the voter is going to say, you know what, whether I back your ideas or not, I have to survive. I have to live. And so I'm going to have to vote for the person who can actually take care of my family best. And if you can't, the excuses you provide are politicians' excuses, but I need a dentist's office. And so this is a sort of cat and mouse game that you see happening wherever you come down politically.
Will Dobson writes in The Dictator's Learning Curve, he says, we like to believe that authoritarian regimes are dinosaurs, clumsy, stupid, lumbering behemoths, reminiscent of the Soviet Union in its final days or some insecure South American banana republic. Not so, he says. Things are subtle now. They're savvy and very often working, but there's work against that push as well. Let's go to our listeners, Michael in Bluffton, South Carolina. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. This is quite a conversation, and I am in pretty much total agreement with your guest. I am recently almost a year married to a Russian citizen, mm-hmm. and she is unfortunately totally non-political, but I have many, many friends in Russia and Uzbekistan and a few other foreign countries who are really, really pro-Putin until this last go-around. They've finally realized that they've been duped, and they now call him the tyrant of tyrants. Even though he's not killing people, it's unfortunate, they say, because the Russians don't have the stomach to have a Syrian revolution or an Arab Spring. They've been there, they've done that, and they don't believe it gets them anywhere. It's very depressing. They're depressed. It makes me depressed.
You think it's fair to call it a dictatorship, Michael?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly what they're saying. It's a dictatorship without the word. For example, if you watched the news just a week or so ago, I can't remember her name, the very pretty young lady who they call their Paris Hilton. God, I can't remember her name for the life of me. They broke into her apartment, or as they call it, their flat, and found $1,400,000 in cash, confiscated it, put her in jail for 24 hours, realized the cash was legal, and she had full documentation of the cash because she's an exceptionally wealthy young lady. But yet they were able to stifle her and keep her away from the pro-democracy or pro-opponent rallies by doing that.
So, a lot of ways to do it. Michael, I appreciate your call very much, a kind of first-hand report there. Let me get one more, if I may, from Toronto, Canada. Saad is calling. Saad, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I wondered if I could ask your guest, there's this opposing kind of trend where you see in Belarus or Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan, dictatorships are becoming more hardline, and they're not actually softening their touch but cracking down more on the citizenry. And if you could maybe just speak to the contrast between dictators like Alexander Lukashenko and Putin's more democratic approach in governing.
So let us pick it up, and it's a worthy question at a time when, look at Syria, that's hardly subtle, Will. I mean, even Egypt, yes, there's an election going on and all the rest, but, they're also throwing out parliamentarians.
Yes.
What about that?
Right. Yeah, no, there are a number of really good questions here. So, I mean, on the Lukashenkos of the world, the caller is absolutely right. I mean, what we find is that there's a moment now where regimes are trying to test and figure out where is the best place to go in terms of what is the correct amount of pressure to apply. In fact, Lukashenko has in many ways, some of the innovations that we see in a place like Russia, actually, some of them, Lukashenko should get credit for the authorship of. The one that I mentioned earlier, the creation of a body outside of the legislature itself to provide some of the functions. That's something that Lukashenko understood many years ago.
Sort of ersatz in parliament that you don't have to take seriously.
Exactly. So, I mean, but it is the case that they are cracking down and they're trying to figure out where the correct red line is on where they should apply pressure without somehow overreaching, which is what we don't see in a case like Syria. In the case of like Syria, essentially Assad has taken a page out of his father's book. He's not really paying attention to his peers here because, what we're seeing and what we've seen over the last, more than a year now in Syria is a very 20th century sort of approach to this where Assad opted for violence almost right away. We had a few promises of speeches and concessions, but then those speeches actually were harsh denunciations and then followed by violence and a crackdown. His approach is to try to cow the population, which was his father's approach in 1982 when he brutally crushed an uprising in Hama, killing more than 25,000 people in the space of the month. But here's the difference. We're actually watching Assad's crackdown happen, whereas his father's was one that we didn't get to see. We couldn't there wasn't nearly the outcry or the sort of international pressure on his father as there is today. That is precisely an excellent sort of bookend, if you will, of sort of how it's so much different and more difficult for a regime like the son than it was the father's. What you see in these places is, and the way we should imagine this to some degree is that you have people that are tied to the regime and that are loyalists, and you have people that have committed themselves already in their opposition. When you add up those two sides, you still have 80% of the country left. And this is ultimately a battle for that middle. Who is more persuasive in sort of guaranteeing that the future of this country is going to be one that'll be better for you? And that's why I think the Assad approach has been one that is already proven to be bankrupt, and his time is limited.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new subtle face of dictatorship and what my guest today, Will Dobson, describes as a still ongoing contest between dictatorship and democracy globally and within many countries at this point. His new book is The Dictator's Learning Curve Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. It talks about all kinds of new subtlety and savvy within and around the authoritarian impulse and reality. Will Dobson joins us from Washington. Let's take a call from Austin, Texas. Matt's on the line. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Real quick, before I made my point, I just wanted to mention I have a good friend from Venezuela, and she actually can't return to the country because she lost her citizenship due to the government taking it so that they could give it to another individual that they knew would vote for the person they wanted them to vote for.
Interesting. And what do you see more broadly, Matt?
Well, I think that for a long time, not just real recently, you know, dictatorships aren't as simple as we may see them to be. I think in hindsight, they often look preposterous, like there's too much grandeur with, you know, like Stalin and looking back at Mao. But really, if you look at the historical evidence, like with the Gang of Four with Mao, or the Bolshevik Revolution leading up to the change in Russia, there really was a lot of intrigue, and there's a lot of subtle manipulation that is, I think, lost when we look back at it. But the complexity has been there, and I think it has just increased over the last several decades, especially with the dawn of you know, internet and social media and the wiretapping technology that is now available to those regimes.
Thanks for that, Matt. Will Dobson, it's never been as simple as the mass rally, you know, in Tiananmen Square, and I don't mean 1989 or the or the parade past, you know, in Red Square in Moscow. It's never been that simple, says Matt.
Right. Well, I mean, was there political intrigue and power plays at the top of these political, you know, country bodies, institutions? Of course there was. But it's a very different, you know, to focus on the example of Mao, for example. You know, one of the chief insights of the Chinese Communist Party is that they recognize that they do not have and will not have another Mao or Deng Xiaoping, which they were really rare in that they were two men who had credentials that went all the way back to the founding of the party, to the Long March, to the Chinese Civil War, and the founding of the People's Republic in 1949. These were men that could really sit astride all of China, and that with Deng's passing, there would not be another leader that would really be of that stature. And so Deng Xiaoping, it's a lot of people don't realize this, but Deng Xiaoping, he understood that he needed not only to pick his successor, he needed to pick the next two successors.
And so he did.
And he did. And we're seeing that changing of the guard just later this year. This will be the first leader when Hu Jintao steps down later this year, who won't be Deng's successor. And this is meaningful because the party has, we don't think of China as being, you don't really think of Hu Jintao as being at the level of a Putin or a Mubarak, because the party doesn't want you to think of it that way. I mean, I was in China 10 days after Mubarak fell, and I was interviewing members of the Chinese Communist Party and asking these questions, and they said, look, first of all, one of them made a joke about Mubarak and said, wait a minute, one guy ruling a country for 30 years, who does that anymore? They know well enough that they need to change the face of the regime. So they have a norm in place, not a law, but a norm that you get two terms and then you step down.
The face changes, but the power structure doesn't.
Right, that's right. And they have, you know, if you want to really find the experts of the Soviet Union's collapse, they reside in China today, because in 1989, in the wake of Tiananmen Square and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Chinese didn't turn inward. They didn't crack down and make a police state after 89. Rather, they went and studied the example of the Soviet Union. They sent researchers to comb the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc countries to figure out, what did they do wrong? Let's do an autopsy of these regimes and then not make the same mistakes. And so what we see is an acceleration of the opening and a new compact with the society where they say, you know what? We don't care what you think of us. We're not going to run campaigns into your socialist purity like Mao did. Like us, don't like us, what have you. But if you don't question our political monopoly, we'll let you do what you want to do. We'll let you go into business and even maybe get rich. On those grounds, it was much less taxing for the regime to maintain its control, and it really redefines the red lines into the things that they really need to have. It's a similar situation to what I described at the outset with Putin.
So there's a kind of liberalism there. Think what you like to a point, say what you like to a point, but some essential, there's still the question of, you know, with evolution of the freedoms around that, even if they're just business freedoms. I mean, the presumption was, I think, at the height of the democracy tide, that eventually those would mount up and turn into something democratic, something that couldn't be just driven by one party. Do you see that coming, or is this got staying power beyond what maybe Samuel Huntington thought?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Chinese are now, they're in uncharted territory. I mean, this is really, their gamble has certainly paid off in the sense that since 1989, most of us would not have said, this is a country about to experience its most powerful chapter ever. And that is what has happened. But at the same time, it is a country racked by difficulties. I mean, we have an average of 500 protests occurring in China every day. The regime was very much on edge when I was there watching the events in the Middle East. So even events outside of their own borders, they are very concerned, can somehow tip over the apple cart. People are becoming more politically conscious. And the red line for the regime is really, it's fine if you criticize us to some degree. It's fine if you for you to think that we're not who you would choose. But what is not fine is for you to mobilize or to begin to build bridges across society. It's the right to assemble that is the one that they are really utterly inflexible about. And so a lot is hinging on that. But the task before the Chinese Communist Party is just incredibly difficult.
Peter in Providence, Rhode Island. Thank you for calling. Peter, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I'm actually a PhD student studying African politics, looking at authoritarian rule. Mm-hmm. And in sort of your answer to the general theme, I think that many of these authoritarian rules are sort of in a stable or equilibrium state, whereas your guest mentioned there's a lot of like legal democracy, procedural aspects to it, but the political playing field is very uneven. However, there's one thing I'd like to hear a little bit more about, which is the issue of legitimacy in these elections and the problems that authoritarians have with legitimacy. And sort of one level, there's sort of two levels I sort of see authoritarians playing. One is the domestic level in winning elections that have been rigged or have been tilted in their favor. And then there's sort of this interesting aspect of the international level of legitimacy. And for many of the African states that I study, such as Zimbabwe and the Democratic Republic of Congo, a lot of the legitimacy does come from the domestic realm, but much of it comes from that international realm. And with the increase of election observers from the Carter Centers and the IRI and other groups, and regional organizations as well, how does that challenge the authoritarian's rule on sort of the external or the international legitimacy side of the equation?
Great question, Peter. Thank you. Will Dobson?
Yes. I mean, I think he puts his finger on a lot of very interesting tension points here. I mean, in the case of, you know, I think from the point of view of the international community, there is not a great desire in many instances to question some of those election results. There is a spotlight, but you find that, for example, to take a group like the Carter Center, their threshold for really calling an election into question is incredibly high. Why? Because they don't want to be responsible necessarily for what the ramifications could be domestically in that country for saying that this exercise was utterly worthless or completely fraudulent. I mean, in many cases, these elections are happening in somewhat fraught environments, and there's great concern, legitimate concern, about there being violence. So
there's no international judgment here. Just have an election, and no matter how flawed, you're scot-free.
Yeah.
Or
I mean, it's you have to be. You know, it's very hard to find smoking guns in these, and the regimes themselves have become. They understand the utility in having these elections. Because just the process of going through these procedures wins them a great deal of credit at the outset.
What a murky world we live in then. I mean, who is drawing up these lists that say, you know, we have more truly democratic nations now or fewer than, I mean, who's doing it?
Well, I mean, you have a number of different organizations that study this. You know, everything from organizations like Freedom House to academic organizations, universities.
Are they more rigorous, more demanding?
They're incredibly demanding, but at the end of the day, it's very blurry. And I think that I don't think the metaphor that we should imagine here is sort of baskets where a regime can be deposited as a, you know, clear and ultimate, you know, clean democracy here and a harsh dictatorship. I mean, the polls are obvious. I mean, a North Korea is I think, you know, what we rightly understand as a 20th century dictatorship. It's a police state in sort of the most narrow terms. But what really the metaphor that's better is sort of a pendulum. I mean, to go back to all the way to Paula's question, I mean, Venezuela was a very, you know, imperfect but functioning democracy for 40 years. And because that democracy failed its people, you see a rise of someone like Chavez, who I think is much more than a populist. He's much more clever than that. But you know, Russia, as imperfect as its 10-year experiment with democracy was, it was momentarily a democracy before Putin was able to move it in a different direction. So what you see is a pendulum swinging back and forth, and that's why it's, you know, it's very important for us to sort of look at these things on a continuum.
Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin, and Dennis. Dennis, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
I wonder if some of the lessons from of subtle intimidation from various foreign regimes have been learned by politicians in the United States. Let me give you an example. We had a situation in Wisconsin where petitions, over a million people signed petitions to recall the governor.
Sure.
After those petitions were filed, various right-wing organizations demanded access to those petitions and examined the names of the people who signed them, and created an uproar when they found that judges and mayors and newspaper reporters, et cetera, had signed these petitions. And you had situations where, you know, major newspapers in the state actually felt obliged to apologize because some of their reporters signed these petitions. And you know, it just seems to me it's the same kind of thing that your guest was talking about in terms of subtle intimidation, keeping people from exercising their rights in a democracy that have been learned in the United States.
Dennis, I'm glad you turned the magnifying glass around here. We'll look at it. We'll look home a little bit. I mean, you hear Dennis's question there, and just add, I've got one. Here's a listener online says, I wonder if Mr. Dobson's description of Putin's subversion of what is a good government structure on paper is a cautionary tale for the U.S. We have an ideal government structure on paper, too, but it's subverted by flawed campaign finance rulings, outsized influence by deep-pocketed oligarchs, partisan warfare that no longer seems interested in the common good. When you hear that theme there and Dennis's very particular point, what do you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two important points to make. One, you know, I think it's just as at the outset, I think it's really important to sort of draw a line here that I hesitate to say that there's utter equivalence here, because in some of these countries that I'm talking about, China, Russia, and Egypt, the risks for people who challenge their system are just of a different magnitude than what we face here in the United States. I mean, we have rightful concerns about the quality of our democracy, about the decisions that we'll get from the Supreme Court this week and in years to come. There's the concerns about corruption and undue influence. All these things are completely legitimate, and why we're responsible for the politics we have. We're, you know, a democracy is something that has to be nurtured. But at the end of the day, we're not talking about some of the risks that the human rights defenders that I'm interviewing in this book and that I've met over these years are facing. So I think that's one sort of thing that has to be said at the outset. But yes, I mean, I've had similar reactions. I mean, there are a number of, you know, you take some states like a state like Georgia, where you have a Republican governor or a Republican dominated legislature, which is only a few votes shy of having a supermajority. There has been legislation proposed, it wasn't passed, but proposed on cracking down on protests in the wake of the Occupy movement that, frankly, could come right out of a Putin playbook. Now, that legislation did not pass because it even was offensive to some people in the Republican Party. And so the slim Democratic numbers of legislators there combined with some Republicans was able to stop it. But it was proposed, and it was proposed sincerely. So this is something that, because it's fluid and these regimes are using, in many cases, the tools of democracy, there are comparisons and linkages that can be drawn. In the case of China, the most interesting innovations that they're bringing into their system are actually out of a democratic system. They're using public hearings, participatory budgeting, polling, things like this to build consensus, because they realize if people feel as they have a role or some limited participation, they're less likely to try to go to the street to protest, because even if they don't get what they want, they feel like they've been heard. So there are insidious comparisons that I suppose can be made.
So if you want to speak to people who live in democracies, let's say Americans, about how to just keep track of the health of their own democracy as they cast their eyes around the world, but to keep track of their own, I mean, what are the measures by which you say, you know, watch this measure, watch that measure? How do you track it?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, one thing that came through again and again and again when I would talk to people, whether they were in Russia, Egypt, Venezuela, where have you, they would say, you know, what's so important is that you participate. You have to participate, because that's really the most, that's what allows the regime to do what it wants. If it believes that it has a population that is apathetic and unconcerned, You know, when I talk to opposition in Russia, they'd say, you know, this is sort of Putin's cynical view or cynical gamble that people won't care. And that's what changed. And I to disagree with that caller that brought some very good evidence of this, you know, strong arm techniques in Russia, I would say that, you know, he said the situation in Russia is not hopeful and, you know, there's no strength of will to do something like we see in Syria. Actually, Syria is not a good example for the opposition to try and follow. And the situation is far more hopeful because at a base level, people are getting involved and they're participating and they're coming out in the street. And this is a sea change in just the period of time when I was last in Russia, which was before the 6 months where we saw these protests in the street. So participation is enormously important. It's harder for, you know, that's one. And then two, transparency. And that's, I think this is something that any activist, not just in the United States, but anywhere knows. We need to have these watchdogs because that's what keeps people in the system honest. And so those are really the two hallmarks.
And you quote Samuel Huntington saying, you know, watch out if you're not dealing with your country's problems. You quote him saying, what matters is the way in which a democracy's leaders respond to their inability to solve problems that confront their country. Venezuelans weren't solving the problems, you write. They looked up again, and Chavez was president. What you describe, he described as a slow descent into the authoritarianism that rules there today. We didn't get so deeply into the pushback against all this, but you describe that as very determined as well. Perhaps on another time we'll look at it. A real contest here. Will Dobson's new book is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Will, thanks very much for heading out all over the place and bringing back the big report. Much appreciated. Thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Will Dobson. Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.